Good afternoon. We're going to open up the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Today is Thursday, April 28th, 2005. I'm Representative Greg Smith. With me is Robin Lamont, our LFO analyst and subcommittee scheduler, and Kat Bell, our subcommittee assistant. Today we're going to continue the public hearing on Senate Bill 5508, the budget bill for economic and community development. And we're in the phase two portion of our presentation. For those in the audience who are new to us today, in phase one, we were at about the 30,000-foot level where it was an opportunity to get an overview of the Economic and Community Development Department. In phase two, we're starting to delve down into the budget and starting to ask budgetary questions. This is not a policy committee, it's a budget committee. And so you'll hear a lot of questions directed to the budget and why certain programs are operated within the means that they operate within. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because of scheduling difficulties where some of us had other appointments that we had to go to, we have missed the benefit of hearing some of the fine Oregonians that have come. And given that many of us have 3 o'clock, I would like to request respectfully that we hear the folks that have come at a distance before the agency people. We always can talk with them. And
okay. Do we have folks here? Who do we have? Do we have a list?
Mr. Chair, we do have folks that are carried over from yesterday.
Okay, so we have on my list, you know, if I miss somebody, please just speak up. I have Debbie Kennedy, Tim McCabe, Judge MacArthur, you're an agency for Hannah. You're always
look
be
at him back there.
He'll always be Judge MacArthur to me. Kathy Jaworski, yeah. Is there anyone I missed?
No, that's it.
Got it.
That is the list
as far as. Raise your hand.
Okay. Okay. You want to come on up, Vicki?
Sure.
We'll let you kick off.
Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, I'll excuse myself because that's what I intended to do anyway, is just to suggest if it's okay with you that we dive right in.
Is that all right?
That's absolutely fine.
Here's what I'm going to do as well.
Mr. Chair, these people were waiting yesterday to make the presentation, so it may be that you want to get to them soon also.
Okay. Well, Vicki, why don't you stay up here?
Okay, and I have...
Okay. If you wanna. Thank you. Excuse we went around to Robin on that. Sorry.
Traffic jam.
Yeah.
Here's what we're going to do. It's 7 minutes after. I'm going to ask each of the folks who are sharing their thoughts with us to keep their comments to about 4 minutes. So hopefully we can. At about 35 after, start delving into the budget. So, welcome. If you could introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you so much. My name is Vicki Zegger. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Downtown Development Association. And Chair Smith, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to come before you today. Our organization is a 501c3 nonprofit, and our mission is to assist communities as they work to revitalize their downtown commercial districts. And we do this through a multifaceted approach of on- and off-site technical assistance to communities, development and delivery of technical guides and handbooks, and through training and conference offerings. And I'm here today in support of OECDD's Community Assistance Program. I hope that you'll continue supporting this program as it's providing communities with tailored plans and roadmaps as they work on their economic development issues. Downtown development is an important economic development issue. It's about small business development, and it's about really improving these communities for getting other business in. We know through both direct and indirect ways that the work that we're assisting communities with through OECDD's program, that they're benefiting. For instance, John Henkin, who is the city manager in Scappoose, had this to say. In December 2002, we completed a plan for that community. And so I just talked to him the other day as a checkup, how are things going? Well, since then, they've had over $1 million worth of reinvestment into downtown. And they and he said, you know, we can really attribute it to the plan that you put in, that you helped us put in place. It's a roadmap. So, and then Joseph, Oregon. It's a great community. 6 years ago, plus a little bit more, our organization met with that, the stakeholders in that community to help them put together an economic improvement district. Once they had their technical assistance, this community was able to move itself forward. What it did was put in a five-year district that brought in $50,000 over the 5 years. They self, the property owners self-assessed themselves and said, this is important. We want to use it for downtown improvements and to leverage grants. This is our local match. And through the $50,000, $3.8 million has been reinvested in this community through grants, in-kind. The community's turned around. And now it really is a showcase as an art community in the Northwest. Another example is from Mount Vernon, and this is just from a thank you note that we got from them a couple of weeks ago. And the mayor, Sue Neustadter, said, as you've heard, Mount Vernon was successful with our application to ODOT's Transportation Enhancement Program for streetscape improvements. Out of 79 applications, 13 were funded. Ours was number 2. I believe the work we've done with ODA helped convince ODOT how important our downtown project is. So it sets the stage. It makes a difference. But you sort of go, okay, well, are streetscape improvements really that important? They are. Not only for giving pedestrians a better, a safer environment, better shopping environment, but what we're finding out through some work that we did with Milwaukee is that developers need to see that a community is really willing to invest in their own infrastructure, invest in their future. It helps show confidence, faith in that future. What happened in that community is that we had a project where we brought in several developers to walk through downtown and look at it and say, what would you need? What needs to happen for you to invest in this community in a development project? And what they saw is a city with broken down sidewalks, pretty rough looking around the edges in the downtown, in that old traditional downtown core. And what they said to the city is, we need to see that you're willing to take a risk and you're willing to invest in your infrastructure in downtown sidewalks before we feel like that your community is a good enough risk for us to take a chance on as a developer. It's a risky enough business anyway. We need to see some commitment from the city to step forward. So as you can see, these are just some very definite, direct ways we see these kinds of projects are benefiting communities. Indirectly, we're finding that...
I'm going to ask you to wrap it up here really quick. If you just
okay, I sure will. Fossil and Coquille are two communities that when they were assessed through how our program services were being delivered and how they were moving forward, both these communities said they had businesses locate there because the communities had a vision and an articulated roadmap for their future. It makes a difference. These communities' businesses feel like are a better risk because they're very proactively looking at their future. So I guess what I'd like to say is I hope that the committee will continue its support, and I'll be happy to answer any questions I can for the work that we've been doing.
Senator Johnson, then Senator Berger.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Duggar. You're a private not-for-profit.
Correct.
I think is what I heard you say.
Mm-hmm.
What percentage of your income is derived from grants from OECDD?
Over the past biennium, 44% of our projects were OECDD projects.
And what percentage of the gross income of the not-for-profit?
That's going to be about the same.
Okay. Where does the remainder of your income derive?
We do projects with communities, say, that may have an urban renewal district that has some dollars that they can spend for their own services, so not everybody, you know, some communities knock on our doors that actually have their own dollars to spend for this. We also have working relationship with other housing and community services. We also do some work outside the state, so it comes from a variety of areas.
So, follow up, Mr. Chair. So you do work for Housing and Community Services as well on either fee-for-service or line-item grants?
That's correct.
And how much of your income comes from Housing and Community Development?
About 15%.
Okay. So more than 50% of your income is derived from appropriations from two state agencies?
It's... not a direct appropriation. These are contracts for a specific project.
Fee-for-service
projects.
Thank you.
Senator Berger.
Yes, thank you for your testimony. Is the Main Street program still in effect in Oregon?
In Oregon, different communities take on their own Main Street programs. Back in the day, the Oregon Downtown Development Association used to be sort of the state umbrella for Main Street, and we still assist those communities as possible. Back in the day, legislative dollars through OECDD were also our work to communities was to really support communities that had Main Street programs. What we found is that means it's a community of over 10,000. It has to have a full-time manager. And if you get to a point of that with a community, they've got some capacity of their own. What we found is that there were many, many, many more communities that were being left out, rural and smaller communities in Oregon that could not access the kind of technical assistance that they needed. And so we've really shifted our services to provide more tailored assistance to these smaller communities.
Okay. Hello?
So what percentage then would you say of these 44% are from cities of 10,000 or less? Would you say that the
majority of
them that you help?
Most of them. We did do some work in Redmond and Prineville, and those are larger communities, and neither of those projects came out of a contract with Oregon Economic and Community Development. They came out of different places, and those were probably some of the larger ones.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Your funding, how is that a direct grant from the department?
No, not at all. We... last biennium, the department put together an RFP, request for proposals, asking for service providers to put together work plans on delivery of services. What we did was put together something called Ready, Set, Grow. And through that, then they put together lists. We bid on projects, some projects, because they ask for innovation and new services. We put together a new line, more targeted towards business development. And so for things that we were innovative on, we're the only ones on that can deliver those services.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Duggar, I'm at a disadvantage that my calendar is on its way down here that had this attachment clipped to it, so I'm operating slightly from memory. You and I had the occasion to visit some time ago when you were doing a branding initiative in Astoria, and I noticed in a summary of some of the fee-for-service work that the chair had solicited from the department that there was a branding initiative in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys do that one?
We're in the process. The Astoria one hasn't started yet.
I remain mystified as to why we have these multiple branding initiatives. I have just come this morning from a Brand Oregon meeting. At the request of the governor, I chair that board. And I simply am at a loss to understand why we have these multiple branding initiatives. And I'd like you to try to help me.
I would love to do what I can to explain that to you, Chairman Smith, Senator Johnson. And you and I had talked about this earlier. Brand Oregon, everything that we put together as far as when a community says, you know, we really need to look at how we position ourselves within the local how people think about us, but also for visitors, for business. There are different ways of how people look at our community. And everything that we put together fits under Brand Oregon. However, for Lebanon in particular, this was a community that actually is a little bit tough because they said, okay, we're the gateway to the mountains. We're, you know, we're close to universities. Well, a gateway, you go through it. You don't stop. And there are other communities close to I-5 and the universities. What's going to set you apart? What's going to make you different? And so it was kind of a challenge to sort of look at all the pieces of this community to say, what is it that is actually different, and how can we sort of position you when businesses come to town? Well, you have affordable housing, and yes, you do, you are close, and you sort of hit these lists of things. So for them, the issue, I think, and this is still in the formulation stage, is about access. This is a community of access. You have access to affordable housing for your workforce. You have access to good medical facilities. You have access to, and so for them, just it's going to be a multifaceted approach once they sort of know, yes, this is who we are and what sets us apart as unique, and then to build the other pieces of logo, tagline, and then how to move that forward around that. So it still fits within Brand Oregon, but for this community, and they're also planning on being the first wireless community around. So again, it's access. And it just helps position this community to help them move forward, particularly in their business development.
Thank you for that explanation. I have to say I still am not convinced that we don't have great redundancy here, and that we ought to house all of these branding initiatives in one place. I've been very impressed with the way, and I think we'll hear from it, from the folks involved with Brand Oregon, how they've leveraged participation from some of the huge advertising companies with international reputations. And I just don't know why we have scattered branding initiatives. I will readily admit I've missed a couple of the meetings given at Brand Oregon, given my legislative responsibilities, but I don't know where the connect point is, whether you're off doing something Lebanon-specific or there's a true connect point at Brand Oregon. It just seems to me incredibly redundant to be paying your not-for-profit for fee-for-service while we're at the same time having a branding effort that's a statewide branding effort, and it just eludes me.
Let me just add to that, and then perhaps you can respond with one last thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to give everyone an opportunity to respond. In this committee went through and did a prioritization of each program unit activity.
Mm-hmm.
And have you had an opportunity to see?
No.
Okay. One of the areas that traditionally has funded Oregon downtown development, unfortunately, was 23 down on the list out of 23. Share with us what we missed and why we should move that higher up the rank.
I guess that's really sad to me because downtowns are important for a couple of reasons. And Senator Johnson, I'll try to wrap this back around to address your issue as well. I hear two different questions or statements. We really support small business development, and I know small business development centers do too. That's really kind of a one-on-one, whereas we will go in and help really look at what the market dynamics are within a region, what the how the customers, who are the customers, how they shop, what are their psychographics, what are the niches that this community can really develop to help those small businesses succeed. Now, on a small business level, if you look at...
I'm going to interrupt you just really quick, and I truly apologize. Before you students leave, could you introduce yourself to us really quick? Where are you from? Well, we welcome you to the Capitol. I hope you have a great day while you're here with us. We also have another special guest just very quickly. Mike, why don't you introduce your son for us today?
Pat Bell has a daughter with her, too.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, thank you. This is my son, Neil Salzgiver. He attends Centennial Middle School in Freshman.
And if he stands up, you'll notice he's just about a half an inch.
Very good.
We all.
Yeah. My retirement plan.
That's right. Thank you. It's great having you here. Thank you, Stephen. We also have another special guest. Kat, you introduce your daughter to us?
This is my daughter, Hannah. She goes to Jackson Middle School also.
Welcome.
Great.
Your mom does a terrific job. You know that? I apologize for the interruption.
It's okay. I can pick right back up. Small business development in a critically important piece. Now, for locally owned businesses, and that's what downtown development is, small independent businesses. If you look at the multiplier effect for a small business is compared to, let's just say, a chain and not even a big box. For every dollar spent, 45 cents of that dollar recirculates back into the local economy with a locally owned business. Now, with a chain, that's 13 cents per dollar. I don't know. I think that's pretty important because I know jobs are important, business is important, this is what, you know, this is very important. So it kind of surprises me that we ended up so near the bottom of the list. As far as downtown development, I did just kind of point out with some of the streetscape why, and it's not just flower baskets, but it's really infrastructure developments that helps spur other development. It gives a signal to businesses to locate there, and it also gives a signal to developers to come in and redevelop there. So I think those are good reasons. And as far as I respectfully disagree that I don't see the redundancy. I see these pieces fitting together with the pieces that we are developing in the work plan, in the scope of work, and coordinating as we can with Brand Oregon to fit the pieces together. But each community, Brand Oregon's a wonderful thing, but each community that feels like they themselves would like to set themselves apart,
great,
that benefits them.
I'll share with the committee, the downtown development folks did a fabulous job in Heppner, and so I compliment you for that work. Thank you very much for coming to testify.
Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't we ask Debbie Kennedy and Tim McCabe if they would come up and join us.
Chairman Smith, members of the committee, again for the record, I'm Ron Fox, manager of the Business Development Division, and while Tim and Debbie are taking their seats, I just want to go back. Their presentation is a portion of the presentation you heard yesterday, or continuation of the presentation, on the investments made from our industry sector outreach fund. You recall I mentioned that there were two major components of investments for this current biennium: lean manufacturing assistance to Oregon's small to medium manufacturing firms and Market Oregon. So Tim McCabe from the Oregon Economic Development Association and Debbie Kennedy, director of Brand Oregon, will just complete that presentation by telling you how both the association and the Brand Oregon effort are marketing Oregon both products and business opportunities.
Really quick as you begin, explain for the committee, is there a difference between Brand Oregon and Market Oregon?
Chair Smith, members of the committee, I will start out and I'll let Tim and Debbie expand on that, but the Oregon Economic Development Association has had a long participation, a history of joint participation with the department, and we began with an investment in the association's business recruitment effort early in the biennium while the Brand Oregon initiative was under development. So this is a continuation, I think, at least at the business recruitment effort, of an effort undertaken early in the biennium with Oregon Economic Development Association, and then really a collaborative effort continuing on through the latter part of the biennium.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I explained both of them are limited in time, so I hope they'll follow through.
Mine's 2 minutes. That's what he told me I had. So.
Mine's 2 hours. For the record, my name is Debbie Kennedy. I'm the director of an enormously exciting program called Brand Oregon, and I'm very pleased to be here today. Well, the purpose of Brand Oregon is to build Oregon's economic health by applying unified branding practices to Oregon's products, people, and places. And the goal is to increase sales of Oregon products, add new jobs, and add additional revenue to Oregon's general fund. let me just spend a few minutes talking about what branding is, and I'm sure everybody has an idea in their own head. But simply put, in my mind, a well-built brand can be typified by the difference between a plain white T-shirt on sale at retail for $15 and the same white T-shirt with a Nike swoosh on it on sale for $20. And that, in a nutshell, is what we're attempting to do with Oregon products. On the business-to-business side and in terms of business recruitment, the point of building a brand is to manage your own reputation rather than having others manage it for you, others such as the media. So, therefore, the goals of Brand Oregon are to create dynamic partnerships among various industry sectors and to cooperatively promote products, destinations, and services under a unified brand identity. We have also managed, I think, through this initiative, which is the first in the country of its kind, to create a fresh, creative, and forward-thinking program that has received a substantial amount of national media attention, having been featured on National Public Radio's Marketplace and also in the New York Times. We now have four different states in the country that have been attempting to follow the model of Brand Oregon. In working with state agencies on the branding program, in our first year and a half effort, we've focused our efforts on coordination of agriculture, tourism, and business recruitment marketing. Our first effort was a seafood campaign, and I think it was a breakthrough effort in the fact that the four main seafood commodity commissions, which were salmon, troll, Dungeness crab, and albacore, had never worked on a joint marketing project before. And so we started with a billboard and radio campaign created by Portland's Wyden and Kennedy. And I don't know if you saw any of these, but I brought them for fun. This is an example of what one of the billboards looked like. We also had revolving different creative for salmon, shrimp, and albacore, and crab. And retailers participated in this promotion. I want to tell you that the Brand Oregon Funds leveraged a 1 to 10 leverage on this with donations from the private sector to the tune of $195,000 and $60,000 from the Seafood Commodity Commissions. Results of the promotion, salmon prices last year, and I am the first to say that Brand Oregon does not get all the credit for this, but nonetheless, salmon prices last year were up 77%. Pink shrimp was up 60%, and albacore tuna was up 22%. And you might ask yourself, well, just because you're driving up price, does that mean the product sells through at retail? And I can report that Zupan's chain in Portland reported a 34% increase in sales of Oregon seafood, and Ross and Salem reported a 50% increase, which is really pretty extraordinary numbers.
Do those increases pass on to the fishermen?
Yes, well, especially in the case of salmon, because so much of the salmon is caught and sold right off the boats. But yes, there was an estimate done, and I don't recall the number, $6 million, I think, in that range, back into the Oregon coastal economies as a result.
Awesome.
Our next promotion on the agriculture side was a program that we put together last fall called Oregon Bounty. That was a cross-promotion between the wine industry, which is a $1 billion industry in our state, the Pear Commission, our new state fruit, the Hazelnut Commission, our state nut, and Oregon Handcrafted Cheeses. And the concept of this promotion was visit one of the participating 50 Oregon Bounty wineries in the month of November and get free samples of these other foods. It was a radio campaign that stretched from Seattle to San Francisco, and winery traffic was up 40%, and wine sales were up 50%. So I think it's very clear that Brand Oregon drives consumer spending behavior. These kinds of increases are really unlike anything Wyden Kennedy has ever seen before for any of their clients, and they've actually submitted the Brand Oregon results to a thing called the Effie Awards, Effectiveness of Advertising. So we know it can drive consumer behavior and sell Oregon products. The question is, can it recruit business to Oregon, which is our other effort? And we launched a business recruitment campaign 8 weeks ago. Our business recruitment campaign looks like this. It's the picture of the governor, and the headline says, "Come for a week, stay forever." And this is obviously what I was talking about when I said business-to-business advertising is managing your own reputation, and this headline is a direct reversal of a reputation that we have had in the past. And I'm going to let my colleague Tim McCabe talk about results of this campaign.
Thank you.
It is.
He said 2 minutes now.
How did she do?
She said 2 hours.
I know.
She deferred an hour.
He's
and
given
20 minutes
that.
To you.
Good afternoon. I'm Tim McCabe. I'm a manager of economic development for PacifiCorp, and I'm past president of the Oregon Economic Development Association. I'd like to thank Chair Smith and members of the Ways and Means Committee for allowing me the opportunity to present a very brief history of the Oregon Economic Development Association and our relationship with the Oregon community. It's so hard not to say OECDD. The Oregon Economic and Community Development Department and Brand Oregon to highlight some of our business recruitment successes over the past 6 years as a result of these relationships. I'm sure each of you remembers the economic vitality the state enjoyed in the 1990s. Most of this was a result of growth in the high-tech industry in the greater Portland area. Because of this prosperity, the focus of the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department shifted from marketing Oregon to businesses outside the state to improving infrastructure in rural Oregon. However, many of these rural Oregon communities were not enjoying the same economic vitality that the Portland area enjoyed. In an effort to promote these communities, the Oregon Economic Development Association was established in 1999 by economic development professionals from throughout the state. Our goal was to assist the state in marketing Oregon. At that time, we created an Oregon marketing campaign that targeted specific industries, trade shows, and site selectors. Over the next 5 years, we raised over $800,000 in donations, and the state matched $750,000 of this to assist us in our marketing efforts. $250,000 of this was in the last biennium. Our recruitment successes included Dell Computer in Roseburg, Oregon, T-Mobile in Redmond, Cardinal Glass in Hood River, Lighthouse International in Medford, NEW Customer Service Companies in Klamath Falls, a Staples Distribution Center in Gresham, Amy's Kitchen in Medford, and Supreme Corporation in Woodburn. These successes have created thousands of jobs for Oregonians. Additionally, we created Oregon Prospector, the only statewide GIS-based industrial lands database in the country, and OregonForBiz.com, an Oregon informational website for business and economic development. In February, as Debbie said, in partnership with Brand Oregon, we began a business recruitment advertising campaign in selected markets in Northern California. Of the 102 business leads the department has received since February, 39 can be directly attributed to this campaign. I believe it is imperative that the marketing efforts of the Oregon Economic Development Association and the Oregon Economic Community Development Department continue well into the future, and I would recommend, based on the success of our very limited advertising campaign, that we greatly increase the advertising dollars available to Brand Oregon. Thanks.
Well, let me ask the question I assume Senator Johnson would ask, and that is why do we have two marketing efforts?
When you say two, I'm not...
If I'm confused here, I openly admit that. Brand Oregon, Market Oregon. I assume those are two different.
I
need help clarifying.
Okay. In 2000, we created what we called an Oregon franchise marketing campaign, that exclusive of Brand Oregon at that time because it wasn't here. And what we did was we picked selected trade shows and industries throughout the country. We created a booth. We went to those trade shows specifically to recruit industry that we were targeting at that time. So, and the communities that are part of the Oregon Economic Development Association picked the industries that they wanted to try to attract to their specific communities. And Brand Oregon's inception 2 years ago, we felt that it was imperative that our community send a unified message. As Senator Johnson was speaking, we feel it's important to send one message out about Oregon, not that Medford doesn't have an important message, but if we send out a unified message, always looking the same, they're going to see that message, the Brand Oregon message that looks like a book, and they're always going to equate that with Oregon, and that's our intent. So Brand Oregon is part of our overall marketing campaign.
I have a question.
Senator Westland and Representative Richardson.
Ms. Kennedy, I must say that in spite of the exceptional work
that Brand Oregon has done. I have a bias, indeed a prejudice, against Brand Oregon. It seems a distinguished member of this panel actually arranged a dinner on the deck of my humble abode and then failed to show up. I won't mention any particular name. However, it is worth it just to see you get red-faced.
Mr. Chair, in defense, press of other business.
Thank you.
Senator Westland, if I might say, I'm having a dinner at my home to introduce Martha Holmberg, the new editor of Food Day, to Oregon cuisine, and the dinner is being cooked by the chefs from Wildwood, the Heathman, Paley's Place, and Carafe. And if you'd like to attend that dinner as a make good.
Well, as long as a certain senator isn't invited, I would be delighted.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. McCabe, would you go into a little bit more detail as to whether or not the trade shows that that you did, or where they were done, and was there success from it? And also, has there been any discussion about doing international trade shows to help bring business from other countries?
Senator Richardson, Chair, that's a very good question. There's been a lot of discussion, but there aren't funds available for us as an organization to do that. And we've really targeted our efforts around the state's identified industry clusters. So we're doing everything we can to support Oregon Economic Community Development Department. The success is from the trade show. Dell Computer's success is a one that we met at a trade show that weren't aware. As Debbie stated earlier, one of the misconceptions that's still out there in every trade show, Senator Richardson, that we go to, we do hear Governor McCall's statement. It's still out there. There's a huge misconception about how difficult it is to do business in Oregon. And our job, we feel, when we go out there is to educate people on this state that we're open for business, that it's the ninth most business-friendly tax state in the nation, and we can change people's opinions about Oregon. Dell Computer is one of them. T-Mobile was another that we were introduced to at a trade show. I'm trying to remember. Amy's Kitchen was at a food processing show, the one that's going to locate in Medford. We're working on two more right now that we're not at liberty to talk about, but they're all. The trade show has been for us the best vehicle because we get face-to-face with people that are interested.
Representative Avakian.
Were you done? I
want to say one. Oh, I apologize. Representative Richardson.
I would like to just mention that a couple of years ago I led a trade delegation, and we did one in Xiamen, China, which is in Fujian, which is our sister state. And the interest was extremely heavy there. I mean, television, the media were there. There were no other states that were doing this. And there's nine major Chinese international trade and investment fairs, and one of them is in Xiamen, and it's the first week of September. And they were very excited about the possibility of us coming back, and we weren't very well organized, but I didn't even know that there was someone doing that kind of thing elsewhere. But I'd love to talk with you about that and also with OECD about getting some help with that.
I think that would be fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, without a doubt.
Thank you. Representative Avakian.
Mr. McCabe, everybody seems to be throwing around these generous dinners, and I just wanted to...
I
wanted to let you know Representative Richards and I are probably available if Pacific Corps wants to do anything. I apologize for coming in late. I was with our chambers. It's chamber day at the Capitol, and so if this was covered before I came in, just let me know. But I'm curious about how you, well, for both of you, I suppose, about how you do your targeting in your marketing, what industries you go after. It sounds like a very thoughtful process in targeting specific types of industries that you think are amenable to getting here. I'm just curious how you do that.
Representative Avakian, a lot of our efforts follows the state OECD's cluster strategy that's already been very well vetted. In terms of the advertising campaign, we had a choice between going into vertical industry sectors following the cluster strategy or to go on a geographic strategy, i.e. target California. And I think you know, at any other time in history, we might have followed the vertical industry sector strategy, but because right now we are so highly competitive against California's numbers on workers' comp, energy prices, housing prices, we decided that represented a unique opportunity that would direct us to follow a different strategy. So our campaign is running in Fortune Small Business, California CEO, the Sacramento Business Journal, which not only ran the ad as a paid advertisement, but then wrote a long editorial about it, which I loved, and the San Jose Business Journal and the San Francisco Business Journal also were in Site Selector magazines nationally. But the trade shows follow more the cluster strategy.
May I?
Please follow.
Is it more than of throwing out a wide but a targeted net towards the geographic areas you want, as opposed to picking specific industries that you're going after?
That's a good question, Senator. What we did with the ad that we ran in Northern California, right now we're in a very good position. The state's in a very good position from electricity, as Debbie said, workers' comp. It's a highly competitive field out there. Reno, the Reno-Sparks area, is one of our main competitors, and they don't offer all the things that we can offer here in Oregon. So we targeted Northern California, knowing small manufacturers, because of the energy rates down there and the workers' comp rates are so high, that now is the time to hit that specific area. And we didn't really target a specific industry in the ad campaign as we do in the trade shows.
You're looking, may I? You're looking, it sounds like, not only looking for industries that may be choosing between California and Oregon, but you actually want to just take them from California and bring them up here if you can.
Absolutely. But Amy's
it's
was
both,
a very
it's both,
good,
though, correct?
It's both.
Yes, it's both.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you comment on the slogan, "We Love Dreamers," with respect to its effectiveness? I've not heard that mentioned in any of your commentary.
Senator Morris, it's really pretty impossible to measure the effectiveness of a tagline in isolation from the larger context that it lives in. And when we first launched, I've been involved in both of the state's last two slogans. I was state tourism director in 1987 when we launched Oregon Things Look Different Here, which was immediately vilified as the stupidest slogan on the planet, only to be replaced by We Love Dreamers. But I think I think slogans require a context. And one of the examples that Dan Wyden often uses is that Just Do It is a pretty meaningless collection of words without $2 billion worth and 10 years of advertising behind it. And we had a Brand Oregon board meeting just this morning and discussed again, took everybody's temperature on the slogan, and I think it plays better in some industry sectors than it does in others, but I think most people are coming around now to understand it in the context of all the advertising that they're starting to see in the publications, because it's appearing in everything from Smithsonian Magazine to Golf Digest to Gourmet to, you know, the San Francisco Business Journal. So I think over time people will put a context to it that it doesn't have in the initial stages.
Well, you've got to sell your slogan instead of changing the slogan.
Let me ask this question to Ron. How much of the industry sector outreach money are we putting into Brand Oregon?
Chairman Smith, members of the committee, during this biennium from the Industry Sector Outreach Fund, we've made basically two separate allocations, one to the Brand Oregon initiative of $200,000, and that was matched by at least, if not more, than $250,000 of other private sector match. Okay. We also made two investments through the Oregon Economic Development Association totaling $250,000. That was in the form of an early in the biennium investment of $100,000 that supported the targeted industry sector trade show activities that Tim spoke to you earlier about, and then just recently the $150,000 commitment to support the Northern California business recruitment campaign. So those are the two that are targeted specifically at the business recruitment effort. And I want to say that the Economic Development Association's efforts and Brand Oregon, we've really melded those together, and it's a result of the strategic plan that was developed through the Brand Oregon effort that we are now moving forward with the campaign now. And so the Oregon Economic Development Association, I think, is just, we're just a part of an overall effort. So,
the Market Oregon, how much has the state contributed to the Oregon Economic Community Development, or the Development Association, excuse me?
$250,000 in two contract agreements, one for $100,000, and then a second one for $150,000.
And that came out of the industry sector outreach?
Yes, it did, Chairman.
I want to ask a question. My understanding with marketing is that it needs to be consistent, and you need to be looking over a long term. Can you share with this committee what your plans are over the long term and maintaining that consistency?
Representative Smith and members of the committee, I've been in the branding business for 30 years, and 10 of those years I was running an advertising agency, and I used to tell my clients then that on average it takes 5 years to build a brand, and that of course it has to be fed and maintained for the rest of its life. Our hope, our dream is that Brand Oregon is funded again through the Oregon Economic Development OECDD, and that we can continue with a very clear and concise and consistent campaign. And I brought with me other portions of the campaign if you have the interest in seeing them, so you can see how it all fits together. But we had a wonderful, just to give you an example of how the campaign is designed to work, because some of the industry sectors have adopted it. We received an email last week on the Brand Oregon website from a woman in Northern California who wrote and said, I saw your advertising in a cooking magazine, then I saw your advertising in a tourism magazine, but it wasn't until I saw it in the Business Journal that I realized this was an invitation for me to actually come up and live up there with you guys, and I'm moving. It was great.
I'm looking. So we're doing about $700,000 a biennium.
Well, the campaign started this year. Brand Oregon really began in October of 2003, so we're only 17 months into it. And so far, our budget has been $50,000 from Governor's Strategic Reserve, $200,000 from the Industry Sector Outreach Program, and then the cooperation with OEDA for the $150,000 that we spent in California.
Is that enough money?
No.
No.
Just being very blunt with you, I mean, if you're trying to do an extensive outreach and promoting the state of Oregon,
let me try to quantify it for you a little bit if I can. In consumer advertising, the rule of thumb is 2% of gross sales. In business to business, it's 0.05% of gross sales. So that means that Tim and I should be getting about $200 billion a year. Now, assuming that that's not going to happen, if you look at who we're competing against for some of these efforts, Idaho, for example, spends about $650,000 a year in just cash for their business recruitment efforts, advertising, etc. Nevada, probably much more than that. In our biggest competition on the seafood side, which supports a huge chunk of the Oregon coast, is Alaska. And their budget, I think, is about $12 million for Seafood Alaska. So we have stiff competition. We have, I think, been more successful than we ever dreamed in the results we've gotten, because everyone has jumped on the bandwagon so enthusiastically and so quickly.
Can I ask one last question? To me, it seems like this committee needs to decide if this is an effort worth undertaking it correctly, and which means with the financial resources behind it. The question I have is, what efforts have you, or what thoughts have you folks had on undertaking perhaps like a guerrilla marketing approach rather than a traditional?
Well, I don't know. I think our message is, I think guerrilla marketing works very well as a reminder medium. And we have a much more complex story to tell than I think can be done in a guerrilla effort. I think maybe if we're very, you know, one of the things that we have that would be categorized as guerrilla is we have a wonderful website called www.myoregonstory.com. And if you haven't looked at it, I would really encourage you to do so, because Oregonians are invited to write their own story and post it on the web. And so far, 70 Oregonians have chosen to do that from all walks of life. So that's a guerrilla effort that we direct people to. But I think until our story is better understood by a broader audience, a reminder medium like guerrilla doesn't work for us.
Okay. Ms. Senator Johnson.
If I could just add the penetration of this marketing effort. Anecdotally, I was sitting in the bar at Jake's having a soda water, and to my astonishment, a truck pulled up delivering fish that had the Brand Oregon logo painted on the side of it. And I didn't recall that we had ever had any discussion about painting any trucks, so I raced outside, accosted the driver, and ascertained that he was so pleased to have his products. Wild Oregon seafood, actually caught in the ocean, not growing in some cement tank someplace, associated with this campaign, that at his own cost he had painted the truck in this highly stylized, we have a style book that dictates how things look in the Brand Oregon campaign, but he had painted his truck to reflect the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pride of association with the campaign that caused just a local fisherman to want to have that association.
And I want to add to that, though, and I don't mean to interrupt you. That, you know, to me, that's guerrilla marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm curious about is if there's a way during the interim for you folks to think through creative and innovative ways, such as painting a truck, that we could provide incentives to entrepreneurs to join the bandwagon and do small little but targeted efforts that don't have to cost a tremendous amount of money, but that have tremendous effect.
Let me just follow up on that. As of this morning's meeting, one of the things that was unveiled by one of the Wyden and Kennedy creative folks that you could not buy, I mean, we are getting creative assistance, the state is, from one of the preeminent ad agencies in the world, and he was laying out who gets to belong to the Brand Oregon campaign, because at this point it's getting more formalized. And what caused us to first reflect on who gets to belong, I was approached by a mariachi band, and they wanted to be the Brand Oregon mariachi band, and clearly that was not consistent with the direction that we were headed, but we needed objective reasons to say these folks are in, these folks are out. And so with the help of Wyden and Kennedy, we've now created a book that basically says if your company, if your product meets these kinds of general guidelines, you could easily be considered a Brand Oregon company. And I think as the tagline catches on and the pride of association grows, that giving entrepreneurs the tools to distinguish their products or their services as Brand Oregon services, we now have the mechanism to show them how to do it, to keep a type style that is consistent, to keep a whole feel of the campaign consistent. So those tools exist now and will be rolled out by Ms. Kennedy and her folks shortly.
Maybe Horizon Airlines would be interested in letting us brand their airplane. So I appreciate this comment. We're going to need to move on if there's no other comment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to call up Judge MacArthur.
I think we should just have Senator Johnson eat out more often and accost people.
That's right.
Into economic development.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'd like to ask Kathy Jaworski to join me.
Of course. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mike MacArthur, Director of Association of Oregon Counties. Would it be helpful or hurtful at this point to tell you I'm a dreamer?
I see the Save the CDBG. Is that
My first mission here today is to follow up on Sarah Garrison's testimony from yesterday and to talk to you about the CDBG program, Community Development Block Grant Program. That is a program, as you heard yesterday, that's federally funded. There are certain areas, the urban areas of Oregon are entitlement areas, and they receive the federal grants directly. The rural areas of the state, the grant is administered by the department, and it is competitive. And the various rural areas that want to try and get a CDBG grant apply for that. It's administered, I would say, very effectively by the department. I was part of about six different projects during my tenure as Sherman County judge. And there is an issue, however, with the capacity. It is a complicated program. That's why it's helpful to have the department administer it. But even at the local level, it takes a certain amount of expertise. In our county, we were lucky enough to train someone to manage those grants, for which there's an administrative fee that you can claim. And with that expertise, then we were able to help those city clerks that you speak of, Mr. Chair, work through water projects in a number of cities in our county. It's a program that was in jeopardy, I guess you would say, with the federal government. The president's budget basically eliminated it. And when we were at the National Association of Counties convention in Legislative Assembly in March, NACO provided us with these buttons. National Association of Counties provided us with these buttons. And 2,000 county commissioners stormed the hill. And we're happy to say that the program's now back in the budget that Congress will approve. We visited with Representative or Congressman Greg Walden at that time, and he said he had been approached by a number of newer Congress people coming around saying they've been hearing from their constituents, and what is this CGDB thing? So nationally, it's a very effective program, and we appreciate the department's management of it. So about CDBG, Community Development Block Grant, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Let me ask one question. You talked about the complexity of the program. Here is the handbook for going through the program. Would the counties be opposed if this body decided to try and create a 3 or 4 day program where counties, cities, ports, nonprofits could come together and learn from the expert on how best to put together an infrastructure project, including the block grants?
Mr. Chair, we're very much in support of that concept. There are a number of different trainings that could take place through an institute of that sort. The infrastructure for that is already in place with the cities and the counties and our training programs that we run jointly together. And there are a number of other the department's actually done trainings with the Community Development Block Grant program itself, and so it would be very easy to put together that type of curriculum, I believe.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think it's timely, and I don't mean to presume to dictate your agenda here, but
no.
Given the fact that you were talking about some of the community assistance programs, I'm the immediate past chair of the Rural Development Initiatives Board of Directors. And formerly, this program began under the state, was spun off by the state. It's the community development not-for-profit arm of the state originally as envisioned. Most economic development systems, as you know, Mr. Chair, have a not-for-profit component. I was originally not a fan of this organization as a county judge and came to be a believer and came to be a big participant in the program. And so the director of that program, Kathy Jaworski, is here with you today, and I'd like for her to have a chance to talk to you about rural development initiatives.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for letting me come second in turn. I know you called on me before, and I had thought I was going to be late in the agenda, so apologize. My name is Kathy Jaworski, and I'm the Director of Rural Development Initiatives, and I will try not to use too many acronyms. There's a sign here. Mike Burton asked me to be here today, and I asked him why, because we have received $0 from the department this biennium, which is the very first time I've come before this committee without a handout and without a track record of all the things that we've done with the state's money and an argument around particularly the community assistance program. I'd like to take a broader perspective on sort of what I see going on at the department and how our relationship has evolved in a parallel fashion, and hopefully give a perspective of a non-grantee this time around. And I say $0 because I don't want to give the a total misperception. We did receive a contract to execute this month for the biennium. That's the only contract that we have, and it's out of the community assistance programs. So we won't really be doing any implementation of that this year because of the timing. So I feel like a family member who went away and is coming back home and is looking at the home in a different light. And hopefully, I'm doing this in the spirit, I think, of caring about what you're trying to do, what you're trying to oversee. With all these kids here at the Capitol today, it makes me lonely. My children are in Beijing studying Chinese to do international business, and in Buenos Aires studying bilingual medicine, and neither of them think they can come back to Oregon to work and live, and they're studying things we need because they're concerned about our economy. So the big picture is, I miss my children. I want you to succeed. I want us all to succeed, and I'm here to talk about RDI. So my lens is that it's not the fault of the department that I see the department and its staff very hamstrung right now. And the fact that it took 22 months for us to get a contract to do work that we wanted to do and the department wanted us to do is a clear example of that. There's something wrong with the system. There's some specific observations I have to share about flexibility, about speed, and about incentives that I hope you will hear, not as, because they're not intended as criticism of the staff at all. I really think it's the unintended consequence of lots of decisions made at many different levels of government to try to make the department more nimble, entrepreneurially quick. And it has not had that effect with respect to the programs that we work with. And so this is my lens, but it hasn't had that effect. So Rural Development Initiatives, as I'm sure you know, was created as the Community Initiatives Program of the Oregon Economic Development Department in 89, spun out in 92, with the purposes of being able to act as a nonprofit partner with the state on community and economic development, leverage new resources into economic and community development, and use those resources to make a positive difference for rural communities. And we have done many successful projects in partnership with OECDD over the years. The big picture in looking back at those years is that over the years, the more success we've had, the less we've worked together. And that just doesn't seem right. And I want to give you some specific examples. We started out doing lots of strategic planning, and it's hard for communities. It's hard when you look now at strategic planning. We're very sick of it. Many communities are sick of it. Then they've done that three times around. But when strategic planning was first done in partnership with OECDD and RDI, it was a very innovative thing. The Forest Service picked it up as the model for how to involve citizens in planning for the future of their communities. And when it appeared that people were tired of that, we stopped doing it. And we said, well, how else can we be of value? Communities are changing. We've done lots of leadership training early on in our history, civic leadership training for people who wear many hats in small communities. And we've won national awards for that training. We've attracted multiple new funders to that training, including the Ford Family Foundation, the Northwest Area Foundation, the Sherwood Trust. And now the state has $0 involved in leadership training. I want to come back to that. But we built that expertise and that capacity through partnership with OECDD, and it's recognized nationally as a very unique thing. We worked with OECDD and several other federal and state agencies on mill site redevelopment. We had the first scattered site mill site redevelopment project that was rural in the country, and we're recognized by EPA and recognized in national publications. As hard as it is to develop an old mill site now, 10 years ago, the resources really weren't there to do it. And a number of those sites, including the site in Astoria, in part of, that's the centerpiece of its rebirth, RDI worked on that, again, in partnership with OECDD. We've done tourism planning. Under the last biennium, the Tourism Commission asked us to do some research on best practice for sustainable tourism because the markets that the state was bringing were markets that rural communities weren't catching, because they were folks who were looking for things that we had but that we weren't packaging in a way. And so we used a very small amount of state money to develop a pilot project for sustainable tourism, and we worked with the Warm Springs Tribe last year, and they won the Governor's Award for Innovation for tourism planning. So that was a very small investment. And as I'm talking about these things, each of them is smaller and smaller amounts of money. The investment in the tourism planning was $20,000. And most recently, we pulled together a collaborative to apply to the Kellogg Foundation in response to a national request for proposals for rural entrepreneurship, a major initiative of the Kellogg Foundation for its 75th anniversary. And we called everybody we knew into a room in the Dalles, June 30th, and said, so should we go for this? We organized a proposal, and this is the first public announcement of it because we were allowed to talk yesterday. We got it. So we have $2 million of new money coming in, one of six demonstration projects out of almost 200 applicants around the country to support rural entrepreneurship, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about it. But here's the sad thing. We went to OECD and said, how can you participate? How can you partner with us in this? And the hamstrungness of the way things are now, the only way OECD could participate was to say, we can use existing resources in existing ways.
What's that mean?
It means we have streams, we already have certain streams of money and certain things we can fund, and if they fit, we can fit them into Kellogg, rather than saying, what can we do? What freedom do we have? How can we be entrepreneurial in being a partner? And it wasn't for lack of willingness. I mean, the state folks, Ron and Beverly and Mike Burton, were all at the table working with us. But the nature of the resource they're working with, and I look at the other states that were funded, I'm amazed we got through the eye of the needle, because the other states, with the exception of the Holy Tribal proposal out of South Dakota, the states were proactive in freeing up new resources. And these aren't wealthy places. I mean, this is Appalachia and New Mexico and places that have state budget problems as well. So entrepreneurship is an area that RDI, again, has tried to use this role that we were set up for, to be innovative, go out there, leverage new resources, find ways to help rural communities be more vital as communities and as economic entities, and make it happen. And what I think the dynamic is really that we're a partner or a potential partner. We've garnered resources from many different places, awards for excellence nationally, and we have such a thin connection to OECD now. We have one contract just executed in the 22nd month of the biennium. And it appears to me that if the department is and the state is struggling with limited resources, it's more important than ever to have strong partners and strong partnerships and strong connections and very linked investments. Let's see, what else? There was a couple more things I wanted to tell you, and then I will stop. I talked about the slowness of the contracting process. My observation in that is that we have sort of a tension between wanting to have fixed partners and fixed relationships and wanting to have competition and fair pricing. And the result of that is that things bounce back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth between legal and program and legal and program and legal and program and legal and program. We have 22 separate deliverables in this new contract. 22 separate deliverables separately priced. Just the administrative cost of that is not very efficient. And it's only because we want to work with the state that we say, okay, half of that money we're giving to our partner, we're passing through to our partner, Sustainable Northwest. We're really trying to model just what you want to see. But it's frustrating. I mean, I don't know how many of those kind of contracts I want in the future, and we do have other options. We do have other resources. And it just doesn't seem like that's the kind of dynamic that you want. The other thing that I see happening with the Kellogg grant is that, in addition to the states, the difficulty of being a flexible entrepreneurial partner, because of the nature of the way the resources are set up, this is third hand, so I'm going to put it out there as third hand, but a couple of our partners, so we have 28 partners on this project, have said that they're getting messages they should not apply for state money now that they have Kellogg money because others need it. And that's like punishment for being successful in leveraging resources.
Can you explain that to us?
Yes. Well, some of the funding streams that are available to our partners that would represent state participation in this entrepreneurial development effort, there's so little money in some of those, particularly microenterprise type of programs, that if there's other money to fill the hole, then there's not the right. To me, that should attract more investment because Kellogg has faith in us. Kellogg has faith that we have a great proposal. We have the Small Business Development Center. We have the microenterprise organizations. We have university-based organizations. We have the Food Innovation Center. I mean, a lot of different organizations. And the state is really not able to bring resources to the degree that I think this magnitude of an investment by an outside of the state entity requires. Now, I'm not here to ask for more money because, I mean, we're buried right now in projects, but I'm looking at the trends and the systematically how our role has become smaller as we've grown our budget, grown our influence, leveraged new resources for rural communities, and it seems that we should have more of a partnership with the state, not less of a partnership with the state. We bring more to the table than we brought before, and it appears to have some paradoxical impacts. In terms of what to do about this, I'm very hopeful that at the legislative level, the response will not be to recut, slice, dice, and re-silo things in some new way, but rather to put in place a process for deciding what the priorities at a programmatic level really need to be through an interim working group like was in place years ago. Because at that point, you can look at the system connections and not just the point-to-point each separate program having its own piece. And as a customer of RDI, of OECDD, a past partner of OECDD, a future partner of OECDD, what it feels like from our end is very frustrating at a time when we want our children to move back to the state and be able to take their skills and have jobs here. So in summary, basically, we want to be a partner. If you fund community assistance or you don't fund community assistance, I'd rather you fund a set of big priorities, like we want to be entrepreneurial, we want to be flexible, we want some key partners, and let folks who work with this work with it in more detail so that we can have the linkages in place. What Kellogg noted in the whole proposal process that they looked at is they said, you know, a lot of places have a lot of programs for entrepreneurs, but they don't have systems by which those things are connected so that an entrepreneur, from their perspective, can start at one place and move out the other end and have gotten a very seamless experience. And I think in Oregon, we have lots of really innovative things going on, lots of really smart people, lots of investment, but if they can only be connected well if there's flexibility to allow that to happen, and I just don't see that happening right now. So we will keep doing what we're doing. We have leveraged in lots of money. If you ask me the question, how much money did we used to get, what percentage of our budget is it now, it's zero. But I can tell you more about where we've gotten other money, the magnitude of other money, how our budget compares to the past. But we are committed to rural Oregon communities. We're doing everything we can to bring in the resources that communities can use to make a positive difference. We really want to be a partner with OECDD. I mean, it's like our cousin. But it's very hard the way things are set up right now. And I do believe that there is a role for community assistance. Oh, I remember one more thing I want to say, and this is it, I promise. I did ask Kellogg, so why did you pick us? More elegantly than that. And they said, because we were a brand new collaborative, all the others have been doing this work for a long time as a group. They said, it is clear that you have, as a group, invested in capacity and leadership at the local level, and if you don't have that, you can't do the rest of economic development. And that community assistance piece, both what ODDA does, what we do, what's done in the county offices through capacity building grants, if we don't have leadership in local communities that has the ability to work with whatever resources are out there, the rest of it is built on a foundation of sand. And Kellogg recognized that. I was kind of surprised from Battle Creek they recognized that, but that's why we got in through the door. And we're really proud of it, and we're really frustrated at the same time that we can't do more with the state. Thank you. And thanks for letting me speak.
Any questions of the committee? I have a few questions.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, Senator.
I don't have a question, but I want to compliment you on your presentation. It was excellent.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. And I'd like to compliment the rural development initiatives. It's absolutely fabulous. You were able to step up and put together such an effort with Kellogg's Foundation. That really says quite a bit about regional development.
Yeah, it's scary.
let me ask you a few questions. You talked about capacity building. You folks work with a lot of people in rural Oregon. How important is it to have people locally on the ground who have the ability to work through applications to help put them together to get projects moving forward? And then having it someone on the ground in a community who can help move a project forward.
Yeah. I think it's absolutely critical. I mean, on the ground, what do you mean by local? Depending on the size of the community, it might be at a county level, it might be at a community level. But I think the role of capacity goes beyond being able to put an application together. It's definitely the ability to be a critical thinker, mm-hmm. to be able to recognize assets that you already have locally that you don't need an application for to get to work, to be able to deal with across organization, across different interests within a community, because if there's one person in the community can write an application and no one else understands it or supports it, that's not very good.
So do you view capacity builders as an asset or as an expense?
I'm trying to see where you're taking me here now. You're taking me down a road. I think that capacity building, whether it be people who write grants or leadership training or community planning so that you have a map, all of that is an investment in the future. And so if I were an accountant, I consider that a capital expense, and it doesn't show up on the books.
It really
is a cash cost.
It really wasn't a leading question.
No, I'm sorry.
I view capacity builders as an asset to a community.
I absolutely do. But I know in a time of scarce resources, it also costs money. And so you're saying, okay, well, what are we spending money on? And to me, it really is like a capital investment, and it shouldn't even be viewed as a short-term expense. It's a long-term investment.
You mentioned the word siloing.
Yes.
Is that based upon current legislation?
Well, you know, I don't have the full-time job of analyzing the entire layout and cause and effect of what I see from my lens, so I can't answer that with certitude. What I see is when I go to a state agency with people I really like and respect and have worked with for many years and say, we have the opportunity to bring $2 million into the state for something that's a huge priority, and we can't move off the dime in any way that appears to me to be strategic. It just seems to me that something's not right, and my understanding is that that's happened through layers of multiple things happening at multiple layers. It's not one person saying today I can't do it.
Let me just two more questions. When did you notify the state that you were going to be applying for the Kellogg's Foundation grant?
Well, the time frame was quick for us. I think the RFP came out in May. We organized the meeting mid-June for June 30th. And we invited OECD along with everybody else. Well, we didn't invite Senator Johnson or Senator Westland because we didn't have good food. One of those elegant dinners. But we did invite everybody we knew that we could possibly think of who cared about entrepreneurship, even people we knew who might battle in certain circumstances. And that's when we started, and it was due August 13th. So we had 6 weeks start to finish from that first meeting of the DALs to submitting the application. And that certainly affects to the degree to which any entity, not only the state, what we could say we could put on the table, but the dynamics of how we could even shake something loose from the tree was what I'm talking about.
My last question is during the interim, if there was a work group put together to figure out how to take a look at economic development, would you folks be willing to sit at the table on that and figure out how to work to enhance rural entrepreneurialism?
Absolutely. I'll write that down.
Thank you. Senator Morris.
Mr. Chair, thank you. This would be a question, I think, to Robin. In our Orbitz budget narrative, the section under regional rural restoration, and we have projected expenditures of $3.5 million. How does that relate to the rural development initiative and the topics that we're talking about here in terms of application of these funds?
I'm not sure. I'd have to take a look.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
May I? And then
please.
Perhaps Mr. Burton will probably clean things up after I talk. Senator Morris, regional rural investment are funds that flow through to the boards appointed by county commissioners throughout the state, and those funds implement the plans adopted by those regions. The Rural Development Initiatives is a not-for-profit. Sometimes they do work based on if those plans call for strategic planning or leadership training or capacity building. They can contract with rural development initiatives to do that work. That does occur occasionally. But those funds are based on the plans that are adopted by the regions.
I'm sorry, I did not understand that was what you were referring to. You mentioned $3.2
million. $3.5
million. Right, which, okay.
Ms. Chair, Senator Morris, that's the difference between last biennium's allocation and the governor's recommended budget.
That's the policy option package.
Right.
The places we have been funded in the budget before have been through the community assistance line. In the past, we had a line item, but that was a long time ago. So the community assistance line item has been where funding has come. And in addition, through communities or counties that chose to use the regional or rural investment funds to contract for services that we could provide, that would be another source of funds. But again, I'm thinking, I knew you would ask, or I expected you would ask, so how much state money have you gotten? And the Warm Springs tribe may have used rural investment fund money to hire us to do the tourism plan, but I can't think of anything else on everything that we're doing and $1.3 million worth of work that's come from the state government, indirectly or directly.
Last question, and I ask this of everyone. This committee has prioritized the different program unit and activity descriptions and community assistance, which traditionally has funded activities such as RDI, was ranked 23
yep.
out of 23. Can you share with us just very quickly any last comments you might have on where we missed the mark on that?
Okay, you have a 23-ingredient pantry, and you say, which thing do you need the most? And I want to say, what are you cooking? I think you should be using your interim work group to figure out the menu and then decide where the investment should go, because these things aren't in isolation from each other. It's a system of support for economic and community development, and ranking them and then plucking them off, it just, I don't know what we're eating.
This is a terrific answer.
Okay.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll make a statement and then drop this, but it just continues to bother me as we think about helping our communities and the challenges that our counties and communities have in trying to develop business. And it's a statement in the Orbitz narrative, and it says, without the additional investment, the ability of communities to deal with business expansion, recruitment, and marketing industrial sites may cease to be a meaningful contribution. And the implication of that statement is that communities, in order to be successful, we have got to get them money to be successful. And what bothers me in this whole process is we have created such high barriers to getting things done in this state that we now have to spend money to help communities get over the barriers that we create. And I've made that statement before, and I'll just make it today and then stop. But it bothers me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. We have gone way, way beyond the time we had. We're going to jump into to ports with Mr. Burton. Welcome.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, I'm Mike Burton, Community Development Division Manager for the Economic Community Development Department. On Tuesday, I came before you to talk about this issue with a couple of customers who have been very active in this biennium, Mike Gall from the Port of Coos Bay and Peter Guerin from the Port of Astoria. I thought they delivered an important message. Unfortunately, it came late in the day, and very few of you were still left in the room. I'm going to introduce them, frame the discussion related to ports. Then I understand you're interested in some history related to the ports division. So I'll do the overview.
Could you do the overview very quickly?
Right.
And then I think in the interest of the committee is just tell us where ports have been, where they've transitioned, where are they today, and the rationale for keeping in the governor's budget, keeping them where they are today.
That's okay. Chair Smith. Ports have very broad mission authorities as defined in ORS 777. Everybody recognizes ports as marine transportation entities. In addition, ports have other transportation authorities such as rail, airports, but something that people typically don't recognize is that ports have clear economic development responsibilities or authorities. For instance, ports are an active partner in our industrial certification process. Four of the first 24 sites certified are ports-owned sites. Additionally, ports have unique authorities within ORS 777, such as the clear, explicit authority to build a commercial or industrial building. It's not clear in the corresponding statutes that cities or counties have similar authorities. As a result of these explicit missions and what we see as close mission congruity between the Department of Ports, the Department deeply values its relationships with the 23 active ports in Oregon. To that end, the Department has dedicated funding resources to assist the ports. Included among them are the Oregon Port Revolving Fund, a subset of that fund called the Port Planning Marketing Program, the Marine Navigation Improvement, and the Marine Navigation Improvement Fund. Additionally, other programs of the Department are available to assist ports and cities, counties, etc. Those include, most notably, the Special Public Works Fund. And I'm bringing that up because in this biennium, we got a clear message from you that it's about jobs. Ports got a clear message from you that it's about jobs and industrial sites. The ports have been running, and particularly Coos Bay, Astoria, and some others, have been in front of their communities and taking risks that were necessary to drive the creation of jobs. Because grants are available in the Special Public Works Fund for job creation, and because the resource in the Oregon Port Revolving Fund is not bond-derived and therefore not subject to IRS regulations related to tax exempt or property tax or taxable activity, we have focused our investments for the ports in this biennium through the Special Public Works Fund. To that end, ports have undertaken projects that will create or retain 266 jobs. Now, I need to explain that because you heard from Astoria and Coos Bay that individually they're on track for more than 1,000 jobs created or retained each. When we make an investment with a port, in this case, there's typically a bird in hand. South Coast Lumber is an example on the north spit of Coos Bay. We made an investment on a rail spur there. Southport was retaining, I think, 66 jobs and planning on creating 20 more. So that's where a big chunk of the 266 jobs I'm talking about come from. The investment in rail to the north spit in Coos Bay is driving a handful of other projects in play right now, including a major investment that you heard Tim McCabe talk about. It's codenamed, it's confidential, but Coos Bay is on a short list of four sites nationally for this site, and it wouldn't be happening without the investments that the port made on the North Spit, including a gas pipeline, water and sewer, and the rail improvements. So we're giving them credit for 266 jobs created or retained by the birds and hands, and they're actively involved in many more than that.
Who assisted the Port of Coos Bay in those projects?
Chair Smith, the department has participated with a significant loan in the rail spur, and Department of Transportation used their short line rail authority.
Who in the department helped?
Chair Smith, I understand the question at this point. With the department and current service delivery mechanism for the ports, we have 13 business development officers working with the ports in their regions. We have six people on my unit who have regional responsibilities, and we have most of Sarah Garrison's capital projects division working with ports on significant capital projects. So my estimation is that currently we have about 30 people working directly on ports issues.
Do any of them historically have ports background experience?
Chair Smith, yes. Some of them do. Not a lot of them. Most of the folks that I'm talking about in that batch are generalists. They're economic development professionals, but they're not specifically a ports background, but some of them do.
Thank you.
In addition to our investment activities, the port has an advocacy role for ports, or the department has an advocacy role for ports. We do that both at the state level and at the federal level. We fund a lobbyist in Washington, D.C. to the extent of $144,000 a biennium. That lobby group has been responsible in this biennium for an add to the president's budgets of about $7 million. Going back further, the numbers were much larger. The current administration's kind of ratcheted things down and not given us as much flexibility to make a difference in that regard. But $7 million for 144,000 investments, a good return. Additionally, I participate with a number of transportation-related groups, the Freight Advisory Committee, the ODOT Highway Plan, and we do so on behalf of the transportation interests of the ports. We do so to represent marine transportation interests, but also rail and aviation interests with the ports.
Have you had any conversations with the Oregon Public Ports groups on the operation of ports within the department?
Chair Smith, I have. I meet with all of the Oregon ports, or invite all of the Oregon ports to meetings on a quarterly basis. We had the last meeting 2 weeks ago. We've facilitated at those meetings with transportation and others, and specifically we had a discussion about the future of ports in the department with the ports, the entire ports group, not just the Oregon ports group, which is a group of ports, very active ports that are funding a lobbying effort through Mr. Armstrong.
Who was at that meeting?
By my tally, I actually have a sign-up list that I could get for you, but by my tally, there were 16 ports represented in the meeting.
Did they talk about forming their own ports group?
Chair Smith, I asked the question explicitly. I'd had a conversation with Mr. Armstrong on the day prior, who was giving me a heads-up that there was a discussion moving my way in that regard, so I made it a point of the agenda to ask the question. And we discussed the role of the department vis-a-vis ports going forward. There have also been additional discussions about whether or not ports even belong with the department, and I suggested to Mr. Armstrong in those discussions that the ports needed to consider where they thought their future lied. If they thought it lied with transportation-related issues...
Why would they have that discussion on whether or not they should even lie with you guys?
It's actually a discussion that transportation asked me to surface with them. Okay. So I did. And in the discussion that came out of that, most of the ports recognize that their future lies with economic development, or more largely with economic development than with transportation. And the consensus was that they wanted to be part of the department.
What was their discussion on forming or reforming the ports division?
We had that discussion, as I said, 2 weeks ago. The specific issue that they addressed was they are looking for a dedicated advocate for ports issues. I'm performing an advocacy role for the ports, but I do other things as well. Their statement was that they would like... Their statement, I think, has a couple of drivers. One is... and agreed to with consensus by the group, and you basically asked the questions of the testifiers on Tuesday, but that is that they want a dedicated advocate for ports issues full-time.
So they feel like, while they're appreciative of the 30 generalists, they would like to have someone dedicated to their ports issues?
Yes.
Senator Berger.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to make a few comments. One is that I think in fairness to the department, the state has put the economic development leadership into the ports. That's part of their responsibility, and so I think that is probably one reason that that's been a natural partnership. Also, I'd like to talk just a minute about some of the things that assist the department when they go in to help, like the Coos Bay area, where a lot of success is taking place. And one is they have partners there, the South Coast Development Council, and I've shared a letter with all of you who are very aggressive and very happy to be a partner with them. Also, the port has built up a lot of responsibility and accountability as far as loans and being able to pay back, and they've been responsible in being able to do that. So when you build up that kind of reputation with the department, and then when you have also the community planning and the partnerships in place, it makes it a whole different picture where the department comes in to assist the community. You can't just expect the department to walk in and assist if the community itself has not done an awful lot, both at the federal level in getting money, at the community level in getting people behind them as partners. So I just wanted to kind of put that piece together here so that people understand it's not preferential treatment at all. It's you have to do your own work.
right. That's right. Yeah, the ports serve a very important role for the state, and we have good. We have ports that are just taking off and growing, and we have ports that, right. If we could just put a little bit of oomph into them, they'd take off and grow. So, any other questions?
Chair Smith, I'd touched on many of the outcomes. $6.9 million, or almost $7 million, and adds to the federal budgets. Primarily from renavigation stuff. And this is an emerging issue, particularly related to coastal jetties, where the feds have four of the jetty pairs on the coast are in danger. We need to continue the advocacy role for the federal responsibility for marine navigation.
How much money do we have in the Marine Navigation Fund right now, or projected for the upcoming biennium?
It's a 15 one more result, then I'll move ahead to the budget, because is a budget hearing.
And I
talked about 266 jobs created or retained. Additionally, there have been $34 million in direct investment through the ports, mostly loans but some grants.
This biennium?
This biennium. So far, that was through the end of March. In terms of the budget, there is the governor's recommended budget includes $660,000 for port planning and marketing, which will be two annual transfers. It includes $2.5 million in port revolving fund, which is about... It actually is, because of some recent payoffs, the amount that's available in the fund for reuse is closer to $4 million than $2.5, but we had some unexpected payoffs. And then there's some money left in the Marine Navigation Improvement Fund. We sold some bonds last summer, and we have some money left. I'd like to comment on the future direction for the department. As you've suggested, many of the ports are in transition. Many of them, we heard from the Port of Coos Bay on Tuesday that they no longer own any marine transportation facilities. Those have been sold or no longer under the control of the port. So they're changing their focus. The department is trying to move with them as they change their focus. We see them as a critical partner in terms of economic development, as Senator Verger said. They have unique authorities that we think are a good match. We're committed to moving forward with the ports. With that, I'll close on my introduction to the ports question and answer any questions.
Matt, as members of this committee know, this has been an issue that I've raised over the last couple weeks. At that meeting you had with the Oregon Public Ports Group, my understanding was that they all voted and concurred that they would like to have a ports division. And I'm hoping that you who were in attendance could share with the committee that is actually what occurred.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, that is correct, and I specifically asked them to go to that point. I think it's important to consider that when the department had a dedicated ports division with four staff, which was up until 1998, although it was discontinuous over the period, it wasn't a continuous presence of a ports division, but in 1998, we had a ports division with four people dedicated to ports activities. We also had 167 people in the agency. While we are committed to working with the ports, they have requested of me that we reconsider establishing a ports division, we need to sit down and figure out how to do that now that we have 107 people. So it's a question that we're willing to sit down and work on. At this point, it's not in the governor's recommended budget, but we're open to conversations moving forward.
So if this committee with 1, 2, 3, 4 port people decided that they wanted to at least sit down in the interim and work with you on helping the ports division retool up and re-strengthen itself, do you think the department would be open to that?
I think you've, Chair Smith, members of the committee, I think you've heard a consistent message from the department and its partners that we love an opportunity to sit down and talk about how to make things better during the interim. I also have an overview for the competitive community assistance or the community assistance programs, which you've already heard their perspective. I would recommend that we also sit down and talk about how to do that. I have further thoughts from an internal perspective on why it's so hard to make that program work, but again, we would welcome an opportunity to sit down with members of the legislature, and the more the better from my perspective.
Does it bother you that there's no ports in the room right now and we're having this discussion?
Tara Smith, the ports were here on Tuesday, and...
The ports were here.
2 out of 23.
Where do you think the other 21 were?
I invited them to come to the meeting. You know, it's... I think it's important to talk about the capacity of some of the ports. And I wish Senator Johnson was here because she's been raising the question. The ports range from a port with no, I'd say 23 active ports. There is a port at the Port of Mount Hiar County which exists on paper but doesn't have a budget, couldn't pass a vote, so I'm not counting them. But the ports that do have active budgets are 23. The budgets range from $74,000 annually at the Port of Coquille River, which you've probably never heard of. One of you may have, but I'm guessing the rest of you have not heard of the Port of Coquille River, to the Port of Portland, which has over $100 million. One of my favorites is the Port of Alcee, which has a half-time port director and a half-time maintenance person. And we talk about capacity. Maggie never makes it to my meeting. She won't make it to a hearing. Maggie Rivers is the director of the port. She won't make it to a hearing in Salem to talk about ports issue because she can't afford to make the drive. She has come to a couple of meetings, but it's very rare. But Maggie is, and her half-time director is, building what she calls offices, housing above commercial or industrial. She's in the process of building an emergency response facility that would house the fire department for the city of Walport. She's built a crabbing dock because recreational crabbing is a big deal on Alcee Bay. And we can talk about capacity. My favorite is she's trying to restore a commercial oyster fishery to Alcee Bay. She would stock the bay with thought to be extinct Yaquina oysters and try to create a commercial oyster fishery. And economic development would be the reason to clean up the bay because you can't eat oysters out of a bay that's not certified by the Department of Agriculture as being clean enough. So I think she's doing all the right stuff. Whether or not she's got capacity is a question that I'd love to talk about in the interim.
Well, I just want this committee to know it bothers me that the Oregon Public Ports Group held a meeting, unanimously voted to create a ports division, and when the ports were brought up and asked to testify, only two showed up. None of them mentioned the ports group. And today, looking out in the audience, we don't even have the government representative for the Oregon Public Ports Group here. And I think we ought to scratch our heads and ask, why is that? Especially when this committee watched a port manager come up and shake my hand in Tillamook County saying thank you for creating a ports division. And today they're nowhere to be found in the audience.
Chair Smith, I can't explain why Mr. Armstrong is not here because I thought he was. When I turned around and looked back a few minutes ago, he was in the room. So if he's not here, I can't apologize for that. I did tell the courts that I would represent their position at this meeting, and I believe I've done that.
One last comment just for the committee. Did they talk about their loan program?
They did.
And what was their decision on the loan program?
Chair Smith, the ports came into the meeting with a perspective relative to the Oregon Port Revolving Fund, which was that it should reside with the Oregon Ports Group.
Did they vote on that?
They did not vote on that, and by the end of the meeting, they were saying maybe they needed to rethink that. I think there are a couple of issues at play in that regard. I was asking them who would manage it, who would actually deliver the work, who would do the accounting, who would do the legal work. And a number of them said, well, we hadn't really thought much about that. Additionally, they were talking about a list of responsibilities that would reside with the department, and I've come with cost information on those responsibilities. They would have the department continue to operate the Port Planning and Marketing Fund. The Port Planning and Marketing Fund exists with annual transfers of about $320,000 out of the Oregon Port Revolving Fund into the Port Planning Marketing Fund. Without the Oregon Port Revolving Fund, there's no way for the department to fund the Port Planning Marketing Program. They would have the department continue to operate the federal lobbyist contract. We pay for the lobbyist contract with administrative costs charged against the Port Revolving Fund. So, again, without the Port Revolving Fund, there's no way for the department to fund the port lobbyist activity. And they wanted a two-person divisional staff, which we don't necessarily have a problem with. As I said, we're willing to talk about how to do that. But if you take the fund out of the department, currently we charge off about $400,000 a year of activities of me, certain business development officers. When people are spending time on ports activity, we charge it off with admin charges against the fund. Again, I wish Representative Richardson was here because he's asking how some of these things are funded. This is a program where the legislature has directed that activities on behalf of ports be paid for with an administrative draw off of the fund. So the things that they would have us continue to do would remain, without a way to pay for them. And I think that's an issue. I raised that issue, and so the question was, well, maybe we need to talk more about this. Additionally, I would ask you about, I've been hearing strong messages from Senator Johnson and others about accountability and the need for the department to do business with its customers. I consider a multimillion-dollar project to be a significant project. You were talking on Tuesday about business plans. In the old days, and specifically the Port of Tillamook Bay is one that wants to go back to the old days, the department accepted letters and considered those to be the basis for project funding and would fund the project based on a letter from an applicant. I believe it's bad business to make a multimillion-dollar funding decision based on a letter. You have charged us repeatedly in statute with...
Mike, that's not accurate. Now let's correct this. The port marketing grant was a one-page letter, not multi-million-dollar decisions.
Chair Smith, in the old days, funding decisions were a letter constituted an application, and absent explicit direction from the legislature, with or without a ports division, I would not return to a business practice of making these decisions based on a letter from an applicant.
For an applicant for what? For the port marketing grant.
Port planning and marketing is still an informal process.
Tell me where a one-page letter would be made.
It used to be that the ports division made, in lieu of applications, accepted letters as applications for project funding.
Applications for what?
For all funding programs.
For a special public works?
No, just for the ports programs.
What would those
be? Oregon Port Revolving Fund and Port Planning and Marketing. And I don't think that's...
What's the maximum amount on a port revolving loan fund?
Chair Smith, that's changed with the last session. It used to be $750,000 per loan. It's now up to... It used to be three caps, which were $750,000 per loan, $1 million per year, and $2 million total debt. In the last legislature, House Bill 2300 collapsed all of those into one limit, which is a total debt of $3 million. So at this point, you could have a $3 million project. And we're considering one from the Port of Newport at this point.
Just so we're clear, and this committee can understand that, based on what you just stated, in the old days you would have taken a one-page letter on those.
For up to $750,000.
Let me just ask two more questions and let's move on. Can you share with us how much was granted out in the port marketing grant program in the last biennium?
In the last biennium or this biennium?
I'm sorry, this biennium.
In this biennium, we will be at, we've transferred, we are managing the fund for sustainability. So the admin charges, port planning and marketing will not exceed the interest earnings. And we made transfers of about $320,000. I think it's $319 and change this biennium, or this year. It's on an annual fiscal year basis. And about the same amount. So about $640,000, and we're closing in on that total for the biennium.
And how many, just so this committee understands, how many port revolving loan funds did you make in the biennium?
We funded two projects using the port revolving loan fund, a total of $1.4 million.
Okay, so you've got two port revolving loan funds. You've got grants in the $320,000.
A year, so it's $640,000.
And then what was your administrative cost to do two loans and to do those grants?
For those particulars, I'd have to get back to you with the cost for those, for the ports planning market. The total ports cost, including my role related to ports activities, business development officers meeting with ports, ports activities related to special public works fund, came to about $400,000, or will by the end of the biennium.
I just want the committee to know you've got $400,000 in administration to issue two port revolving loans, to issue marketing grants up to $320,000, and then you also service existing port revolving loans.
Chair Smith, that's true. We also do the ports advocacy function. And as I said, total investment, $1.4 million port revolving fund, $34 million from all resources.
Committee, the reason I'm going into this level of detail on this is because you don't see any people from the ports in the room today, and I think it's important for them to have an opportunity to share their thoughts. So.
Chair Smith, I think it's important to repeat that we had ports people in the room on Tuesday when we were scheduled to to speak at this point. And rather than have this discussion on Tuesday and have people who've driven 3 hours wait, I elected to have them testify to the committee.
Thank you. Senator Berger.
I guess I'd be a lot more comfortable with a little bit more dialogue here or a little bit more inclusiveness.
You've got it. You've got it. Why don't we move on?
Okay. We're done with ports then?
Thank you.
Or at least for today?
We're done. Thank you. Why don't we do this? Why don't we wrap this up for the day? I think that's trying to make the most sense. So, seeing no.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just so that you know what's happening on Monday, we will try to finish up with the agency overview, and then we will do a walkthrough of budget issues so that both the governor's recommended budget and how the dollars are allocated within the program so that you have a clearer picture of how the agency funding works. I think you had a comment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lynn Beaton for the record with the department. And I think I was in error earlier. I thought I had the list of all of the invited guests who were wanted to testify, and I missed one, my fault. So I would ask that you perhaps entertain the testimony of Betty Lou Carrier, who wanted to testify briefly on business finance loan program.
No
if
problem.
That would be okay.
No problem. Come on up. Come on up. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, while she's coming to the table, I neglected to mention there will also be an aviation grant that you will have a work session on Monday.
Thank you. Welcome. It's good to have a business owner before us, so
yeah.
Welcome.
Oh, thank you. I'm not sure why I'm here, but yes, hello. And my name is Betty Lou Carrier, and I own Betty Lou's Inc. over at McMinnville. And just to tell you a little bit about my business, 28 years ago I started it in my kitchen and making healthy snacks for my kids to eat without sugar. And soon people wanted to buy them and stores wanted to buy them. And for 8 years I did it out of my kitchen. And I had a route from Seattle to Sacramento. And being a single parent, that's how I put my kids through school. So I think that's why I love putting so many single parents to work in my business, because I'm passionate about that. But 2 years ago, I had 26 employees, and now I have 68 employees.
Wow.
I have over 100 products. I had two products back then for 8 years. I have over 100 products now, and I'm in a 22,000 square foot building. And most of my growth has been in the last 4 years, and really a lot of growth in the last 2 years. But last year I got a grant, not a grant, but a loan from the Economic Development Department. And it was a huge part of my growth because they were very helpful. They were eager to help. And also to let you know what's available to you and to help out. And it actually helps banks be more the burdens off of them, you know, they're more eager to work with you also. So I grew 32% last year in the business. So and then I've got a loan in right now for another loan. And if I get that loan and I get the piece of equipment that I need, I'll put 25 people to work. So
Representative Avakian.
How did the thought first come into your head in order to go find them? You see it in an advertisement on the internet, a friend?
You know, actually, honestly, they found me.
Tell us about that.
The man that I leased my building from, he was involved with Tom Fox and with who are you? I'm sorry, I know who you are. And so he said, hey, you got, and I was just busting at the seams in this building. I started out in like 8,900 square feet, and then I moved to another 8,000 that he had, and now I'm in another 3,000, another 2,000. I'm like all over this man's property. And he was like telling them, you got to go see this girl and see what she's doing. And that's how they ended up basically at my place. So by them helping me, it helped my growth a lot.
But the grant program is also helped. I just applied for a grant and got it. And the piece of equipment, it's a smaller piece of equipment. I will put 7 people to work for that. That was like, $45,000 grant that's just been.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you very much. Wow, what a remarkable success story.
Thank you.
The piece of equipment that you've purchased for $45,000, who owns the title to that piece of equipment?
Well, that's the grant. That's with the grant. That I haven't even received the money yet. I just got the okay that it was okayed. But on the other bar equipment that I bought, who owns the title?
Well, I mean, does the equipment collateralize the loan at this
yes.
point, or do you have a personal guarantee? Or without going into too many personal finances in a public
mm-hmm.
setting, that piece of equipment. At the end of the day, do you own it, or?
Yes, I own it. Yeah, but it has secured the loan. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dave Dahlin. I'm a D-A-H-L-I-N. I'm a business finance officer for the Economic Development Department. Chairman Smith, Senator Johnson, we have made one loan to
mm-hmm.
Mrs. Carrier.
Mm-hmm.
It was a $120,000 loan, and it is secured by an entire production line to manufacture snack bars. And in that case, we were able to get a first lien against the equipment because the private lender was able to secure their loan with liens against other equipment that she owned. But she does own title to the equipment.
Thank you. Senator Berger. Senator Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My office has been working for the last 90 days, 3 months, on nutrition in schools.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, thank you. I wish I'd have had you along. That's a good cheerleader.
Uh-huh.
It hasn't been that easy, believe me. So I'm very curious. You said you had 2 products for 8 years. What were your first products?
Well, I had these little peanut butter balls that I made for my children. And I know the PTA and the teachers, they would always commend me for my kids being so well behaved, like after Halloween and stuff. My kids would go trick-or-treating, but they wouldn't eat the candy because I read a book to them years ago called Sugar Blues, and then they didn't want to eat sugar. It was like, so they would always ask. I mean, my son was 4 years old, and he would hand a ketchup bottle to my mom and go, "Does this have sugar?" Because he wouldn't want it, you know. And so they, you know, I was always passionate about our health and everything. So, yeah, that's.
That's very good.
Yeah,
maybe that should be required reading for kindergartners.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
All right. Thank you very much.
Any other comments?
You know, I feel like I'm just here on behalf of a lot of small businesses that we put a lot of people to work, and people that would normally, I mean, like single parents and people that would be dependent upon the state to take care of them, and they're not. And sometimes they tell me I'm all they got, you know, and I'm just passionate about putting people to work, and I feel really good about what I do and what I make because it is healthy products, and I am in the process, because schools are looking for healthy products, we are in the process of helping with that, you know, sending out samples to people that then to the schools and stuff. They are looking for good foods now in schools. So, anyhow, that's, I just hope that you keep the programs coming because, like right now, like I said, in order to keep up with my production, I need new equipment and bigger equipment. And because people are coming to us because we make good stuff and we use good ingredients. Mm-hmm. And so, I just say, please keep helping us.
Do you have a business plan?
Yes.
Awesome.
You bet.
Senator Johnson.
One other thing, I just want to make sure I understood this. You've got a mixture, then, of commercial lending institutions that are involved with some elements of your expansion as well as the state. Did I understand that?
Like a bank to work with me? Yes, I do. Uh-huh.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's nice when the state works with us because, you know, they like that, too, because the burden's not completely on them. And being a small company, and especially the way I started, you know, it's helpful to have people like this to help you.
That's great. Good luck to you. It's a great enterprise.
Yeah, thank you.
An awesome business.
Yeah.
Thank
you.
Any other questions or comments from the committee? Wow, this has been a
A fun day. It's a few minutes after 3 p.m. Unless there's any objection, we are going to adjourn until Monday, at which time we'll be wrapping up and having invited testimony from the chair. So thank you very much for coming.
No, she stopped by the house lounge.